You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
As you may already know, I have for many years been under the influence of a mysterious guru from the East, if you consider Murfreesboro, Tennessee, the East. Since I did my last series inspired by Rabbi Rami Shapiro, I've had the chance to meet him, sit at his feet and study, and interview him. Rabbi Rami says that when he went in search of Zen Judaism, he found guidance in Hasidic literature. So I'll be drawing from Rami's book, Minyan, 10 Principles for Living a Life of Integrity, to layer the ancient wisdom of the Hasidic rabbis with Jesus' teachings and the best practices of contemporary spiritual direction for what I think are some no-nonsense spiritual practices for everyday life. For our text today, a very short passage from John. When the author of John wrote these words, I'm sure he didn't know what a Pandora's box of interpretation he'd be opening. It's been interpreted every which way over the years, so it's good to remember the context of its origin. John was written long after the temple was destroyed by the Romans and after the Jesus people had been kicked out of the synagogues. There's a serious competition for adherence between the various remnants of Judaism and the various Jesus followers. So there's a sense that John uses the Jews as foils for his story, discrediting them as fools. As such, you got to be careful reading John, because it's been the source of justification for many anti-Semites. This particular passage is part of a chapter where Jesus is using metaphor to compare himself to a shepherd, a gate for the sheep, and generally put down the Jews. He says, "Very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who came before me, the Jews, are thieves and bandits, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters by me will be saved and will come in and go out and find pasture." It's always uncomfortable for me to read John's Jesus using such us versus them anti-Semitic language. At any rate, our passage is in the midst of this talk, and I think you may recognize our passage from today.
Our words of wisdom are from John chapter 10, verse 10.
Jesus said, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Language is a funny thing. English is particularly crazy for ESL students. Many of our words can mean exactly the opposite of themselves. Take the word fast. It can mean both moving rapidly, as in running fast, or fixed, unmoving, as in holding fast. If colors are fast, they will not run. How about off? It means deactivated, as in to turn off, but it also can mean activated, as in the alarm went off. Or screen. It can mean to show a movie or to hide, as in an unsightly view. So it's with some trepidation that I dip into Chinese and offer a hackneyed old adage, usually offered by non-Chinese speakers. It says that the Chinese word for busy is composed of two characters, heart and killing. Well, I think many Chinese speakers would never think about this. It's interesting, at least, to note how the characters seem to come together. I offer that observation because, for many of us, our lives are already extremely busy or heart-killing. We can't imagine squeezing in one more thing, especially something as fuzzy as a spiritual practice. In 1845, Henry David Thoreau was in a similar place in his life. not the kind of guy that did anything half-heartedly. He took off for Walden Pond to live in isolation and find out, before he died, whether he had ever lived. Good question. But is there more to life? How can I live more deeply? How can I connect with the divine? What is this fullness of life that Jesus promises when he says, I have come that you may have life and have it more abundantly? Let's start out by being perfectly clear. Whatever abundantly means, it has nothing to do with money. Oh yeah? What about my favorite TV preachers? They say differently. Why, yes. Yes, they do. One of the richest of the bunch, Kenneth Copeland, preaches, do you want a hundredfold return on your money? Give and let God multiply it back to you. No bank in the world offers this kind of return. Praise the Lord! Creflo Dollar posted on his Facebook page, Jesus bled and died for us so that we can lay claim to the promise of financial prosperity. Hashtag prosperity in Christ, hashtag wealthy living, hashtag abundant life. If these are your go-to guys, then good luck. They are, in fact, I think, the guys that Jesus was contrasting himself with in the sentence right before our passage today. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. The word translated from Greek as thief actually has at its root klepto, as in kleptomaniac or kleptocracy. In this case, suggesting those who abuse people's confidence for their own gain. So, over the course of this summer, we'll be taking a stab at answering the question, if it's not financial security, then what exactly is this abundant life? Is it being more attentive to the spirit? Is there a spiritual practice I can relate to that might help me cultivate a deeper spirituality in general? Not all 10 of the practices we'll be covering will flip your switch, but maybe one will. Just give it time and be discerning. I'm no expert in any of these, but we're going on this journey to learn together. Jewish writer Avram Davis writes, "We are what we practice. If we become angry a lot, then essentially we are practicing anger, and we become quite good at it. Conversely, if we practice being joyful, then a joyful person is what we become. So the question is, what are we practicing? What are we practicing that helps us be more aware of who we are and how we are in the world? That's why the first step in our journey is meditation. It's a foundational practice that benefits all the others, a kind of anti-busy, clearing the decks to make room for something new kind of practice. So what is meditation? Rabbi Rami writes, meditation is quite simply the ending of thought. It's not joy, deep contemplation, wonder, amazement, or even awakening. It is primarily the cessation of thought. What happens when thoughts cease? I don't know. Without thoughts, there is no thinker. Without a thinker, there is no knower or thing known. Without these, there is no way to answer the question, what happens when thoughts cease? Meditation is simply profound unknowing. But just because we don't know what happens when thought stops doesn't mean we can't experience the benefits of practicing meditation, or how differently our consciousness seems when the mind leaps back into wakefulness, less tense, more composed. Thoughts are less rigid and a little more subtle. Because after meditation, I often feel so still inside. The world around me seems more alive and vibrant. Details stand out. Rami writes, I find myself smiling more easily and broadly, and I feel more in sync with my surroundings. But these sensations are not the goals. They're the byproducts. The goal is ending the mind's chatter and putting the self in the larger context of the whole of which it is a part. Well, hang on, some of you might be thinking. Meditation doesn't sound very Christian to me. Okay, but if you look back at the practices of our sister faith, Judaism, you'll find that many rabbis recommended and practiced an hour of quiet centering both before and after they led a service. Was it planning? Going over their message? No. It was simply being still. Likewise, it shouldn't be a surprise to see Jesus continually withdrawing from people, from life's daily activities, to be alone and pray. The priority of Jesus' solitude and silence is everywhere in the Gospels. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. When Jesus heard that John the Baptist had been beheaded, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. After Jesus had dismissed the crowds, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. When evening came, he was still there, alone. But as Christianity became the dominant religious force in many cultures, what we call meditation today became prescribed silences with chants and rote prayers. Right belief and ritual became the most important tasks. So, with its openness and unknowing, meditation became something of a subversive activity, taking a back seat to the authorized approaches to prayer. But since the 1960s, surprise! And an increased interest in spirituality in general, people have sought out a more inner transformation, something that was open and conducive to feeding the kind of yearnings that rigid outward practices just didn't satisfy. Add to that all the benefits of meditation that today is backed up by all kinds of scientific evidence. And it's no wonder meditation is growing in popularity. It reduces stress and anxiety. It improves sleep and enhances interpersonal relationships. And meditation also improves memory and executive functions. So today, in an effort to deepen people's spiritual repertoire, a growing number of churches and synagogues are facilitating a variety of meditative practices. We've offered Tai Chi here at the Fountains in the past and are currently partnering with teachers who are offering both yoga and Buddhist meditation classes. Sitting in on our meditation classes with Buddhist monk Kelseng Tabke has reminded me just what a paradox meditation can be. It's so simple and yet so difficult. It starts off easy enough. You get comfortable, you get aligned physically. You do whatever works for you to sit comfortably. Then you watch your mind work. Don't follow any thoughts or feelings. If you just let them rise and fall of their own accord, soon the mind will slow its chattering. Deep quiet emerges, and with practice, thought ceases. Get ready for dozens of distractions. Thoughts and feelings rushing in. This happens whether you practice meditation or not. The difference is that when meditating, you intentionally are observing what's going on and are not driven by it. When your mind wanders, don't fight it. Simply let the thought go. Look, meditation doesn't offer a miracle cure. It doesn't promise anything magical. No grand visions, no affirmations, no fantasies to occupy the mind. It's about sitting, breathing, and simply being. Can it be that simple? Yeah, but it's not easy. The benefits for me are similar to what I hear other people experiencing. More calm, less stress, less tempted to identify with all the craziness around and within you. Rami finds that it helps him gain distance from his own desire for control and power and be better able to act in the world with justice and compassion. A student of Rami's who happened to be an OBGYN nurse said, "Meditation has profoundly affected the way I treat my kids, my husband, even my ex. It has a lot in common with midwifery. The world and everything in it is trying to birth something wonderful. And meditation helps me learn to put myself aside and facilitate that birth." And it shouldn't be a surprise that meditation is also a hot new commercial prospect. Current is a meditation studio in a strip mall on Indian School Road in Phoenix, where they say they've reimagined the meditation experience to make it more accessible to more people. With our guided classes, start your journey toward a more mindful and authentic life today. And yes, there's an app for that. It's called Headspace, where you'll be talked through all the basics of meditation in daily doses of 10 minutes to 60 minutes of guided imagery. Suffice it to say, there are lots of possible methods and postures and techniques in the world of meditation. The important thing is to find one that works for you. And if none of those sound like they'd work for you, Brother David Steindl-Rast has written, "Sometimes people get the mistaken notion that spirituality is a separate department of life, the penthouse of our existence. But rightly understood, it is a vital awareness that pervades all realms of our being." Someone will say, "I come alive when I listen to music," or "I come to life when I garden," or "I come alive when I play golf." Whatever area in which you get in touch with your spiritual self is good. To be vital, awake, aware in all areas of our lives is that never accomplished task. But it remains the goal. And meditation may be just one of those vehicles for you. In the second century, one of Christianity's early bishops, Irenaeus, wrote, "The glory of God is the human person fully alive." Life in the Spirit, living life abundantly, is about recognizing the presence of the sacred in everyday life. And meditation can help you retrain your mind to see the world as it really is, the integrated, flowing wholeness of creation, expressing itself as the unique being that you are. So why meditation? Well, it's not an escape. It's just the opposite. It's intentionally disconnecting from the world long enough to see reality in a new and more authentic way. It's an investment, creating space where one can sense a heightened connection with and compassion for all of life. And it's a catalyst for achieving one's highest potential and soulfulness, or to use the word Jesus used, abundance. As Irenaeus said, "The glory of God is the human person fully alive." And meditation may be one of the tools you want to have in the toolbox to achieve that soulfulness, that aliveness, that abundance. May each of us find our way to that abundance of being more fully alive. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.